Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon into understandable everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host and colleague, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today we're going to move away from following all the Trump cases for a while and talk about a legal topic that's not often discussed, and that is judicial decorum. How should judges act in the courtroom, outside the courtroom? What can they demand of participants in their courtroom? And what happens if a judge violates the rules? So let's start with a situation that recently came up that Judge Gale brought to my attention. And this is a situation in Michigan. Judge Kenneth King, he's a judge in a criminal division in Michigan, had a field trip of young people come to his courtroom. And in that courtroom, there was a 15-year-old girl who fell asleep. He called her out, embarrassed her in front of the whole class for sleeping. That was probably bad enough. But then he went forward and took her into custody, handcuffed her, made her disrobe and change into a jail jumpsuit, and held her in a holding cell adjacent to his courtroom. Then later he ordered her back into the courtroom to plead for leniency in front of her peers. Now, this was a 15-year-old young woman. He's been removed from his docket as a result of that. In other words, he's not sitting on any cases as a result of that. It made the news clearly, and he's now being sued by the girl's family. Judge Gale, that's sort of an extreme case, but we see this around the country ever so often.
And I would agree, amazingly extreme. One thing I'd add to that is, as I read and researched more about this incident, because it felt like it was kind of like cumulative humiliation, right? One thing
right.
on top
One
of another.
Thing on top of another.
On top
right.
of another. After he had this young lady return to the courtroom in full jail garb at 15 years old, handcuffed, to present back to the court. Now, remember, she was there with a nonprofit group, and there were other young people that were there as part of this group as well. And so the judge then turned to the other attending students in the gallery of the court, who no doubt, you know, at that point, can you imagine, you know, one of two things happening? Either their absolute paralyzing fright at what they're seeing unfold, or the laughter and the ridicule that compounds the humiliation. But then the judge then allows the other young people there to vote on her fate. Yeah. The young people that were sitting in the room, and again, as if what had happened already was not thunderstriking enough to conclude this experience for this young person with something like that was just, it's shocking. Now here's what I'll say, Judge. I don't know about you, but I certainly have, in my experience on the bench, I have certainly had some outrageous cases. I've had some situations that will test the limits of my patience. I mean, there are many times when my bailiff would say that, you know, there is a special crown and glory for me because I would put up with people's foolishness sometimes. And then other times I would not. And I've had instances when I've certainly been more creative with some defendants than others and more creative with some people than others. But never could I imagine treating a young person like this. And I don't know about you, but I couldn't imagine doing that to a young person for just a whole laundry list of reasons. First of all, we want them to see themselves in these robes because we can't regenerate ourselves. So we got to pass the baton to someone. And if their first or initial experiences with the justice system is something that is so amazingly tone deaf on effect and impact, then you will never pass the baton to one of those young people who, by the way, maybe have made an exceptional jurist one day, perhaps could have been just wonderful. And now you've completely turned them off to it. Now, and then the second thing is, as you know, because both of us are parents, how many of our kids really experience full brain development at 15? I mean, my kid at 25 still has the attention span of a flea. And so I could not imagine punishing a 15-year-old for either falling asleep or chuckling or not paying attention in a courtroom where we often talk about these same challenges with defendants, right? We talk about the fact that we speak a different language that they often don't understand. The proceedings can sometimes be long and intense. If your case isn't called, you might struggle with boredom and trying to focus or even understand what's happening. Imagine what's happening to a 15-year-old's brain who's not there for their own case. They're there just to experience as an observer. They still don't understand. Nobody's giving them a glossary or a lexicon list when they walk in to say, here are some of the words that are going to be used so you can understand it. We aren't doing that. And then to be so extreme over this type of minor behavior is just... Judge.
He did compounded it, his problem, by telling her that she should go home and sleep in her bed. Now, this was a group of students, and some of them didn't have homes.
Right. And so how about that
Some of them didn't have beds.
If they did have a home.
But also, somebody falling asleep, there could be all kinds of reasons. Obviously, in this case, her attorney is now saying that she was up very late the night before for family reasons. And so she was sleep deprived. But there could be medications. There could be attention span. There could be narcolepsy. There could be all kinds of reasons. But
hey, how about the fact that the judge is just not interesting?
The judge jumped to the conclusion that her sleeping was disrespectful of him. And that is a giant leap, but it's part of this egomania sometimes that comes with being a judge.
We call it black rope syndrome, but you're absolutely right. The lack of decorum and the idea, and I think buttressing the idea that many people have already, which is that judges can't relate to regular folks. Right. They just lose connectivity. They work in these ivory towers. Many of them have to look at their government issued IDs just to remember their first name because no one calls them by it anymore because they only are known now by their title. And because of that, they are revered and they're physically situated higher than anybody else in the room already. They wear these ominous black robes and they're peering down on everyone. And again, they're so disconnected from reality that, none of this should be shocking. But for you and I, who have been judges, actually, it is quite shocking.
It is shocking.
I'll tell you, I've had experiences, again, when I have certainly issued some less than traditional responses to certain behavior. But
let's talk about that because early in our friendship, I got a call from a news organization asking me what my opinion was as a fellow judge about this woman in northeastern Ohio, this woman judge, who ordered somebody to sit at a highly trafficked area and holding a sign. Can you get into that? I mean,
I sure can.
And then I realized, oh my God, that's Gail.
Right. Is she cutting up again? You know, I will never forget the case of Edmund Aviv. And this had been, apparently it had been a matter that actually predated my ascending to the bench, because Mr. Aviv had had many experiences in that courtroom with my predecessor, with the same police department, with the same, you know, city administration, and none of them, and I guess I could suspect now why it is, but none of them had adequately responded to what seemed to be this pattern of behavior that was steeped, quite frankly, in racism. From my predecessor to the chief of police, who at the time had been the chief of police those times when he was brought in, and the same mayor that was there. And again, I later learned and realized that, you know, perhaps they all trafficked in the same racist behavior, especially when the chief of police made a lynching reference toward me, the first Black judge in that city. But in this instance, what happened was there was a family that moved next door to the defendant, Mr. Aviv, and that family was a mixed race family, and that the parents were non-minority, but they had adopted two Black children, both of whom had special needs. Now, they had biological children of their own, but their biological children were adults. One of the adult children lived in a home to help care for the special needs siblings, while the other adult child had moved out. And it bear noting that the husband in this family, he also had a myriad of health problems. So his ability to kind of help out was fairly limited. These children were such special needs that they literally had to have the house retrofitted to accommodate them, to include a ramp for the wheelchair accessibility. But there came a time when, first of all, this was the welcome mat that the wife received when their family moved next door to this defendant. She said she walked down the street. She passes the defendant who's working in his front garden. She goes by to say hello to him, and he lifts up from working in the garden to spit on her. That was the welcome mat. And it was just out completely. I couldn't believe it. And this was actually, these were some of the prior cases. And this is how this victim started to lose faith in the justice system, because there had been so many prior cases. And so what came before me was an instance where the defendant, who was an electrician by trade, purchased a dryer, let you put your clothes in. He puts the dryer in his garage, which faces the victim's home. And he vented the dryer toward the victim's home. He apparently purchased some kind of chemical to put in the dryer and started it, such that it, when it vented toward the victim's home, it panicked her because she believed that she smelled gas and sure, that her home was going to explode. She knew she had two special needs children as well as an ailing husband. And she had already resolved in her mind there was just no way she was going to be able to get everybody out. The only thing she could do was pick up a phone, run outside, call the fire department, and call the police. But meanwhile, she was just like, her home, she genuinely believed her home was going to blow up. And so she knew that she could never get them all out, and had resigned to die in the house with her husband and her children because she didn't want to leave them behind. That didn't happen. Luckily, the fire and the ambulance came. One of the children had to be rushed to the hospital for ingesting these fumes. Another one needed care on site. And this was terrible. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back.
What did you do with this guy because of all of this?
Defendant shows up and he ends up pleading to all of these charges. And his attorney I'll tell you, and this is one of the things that the judges have to balance also, right? Is that zealous advocacy. I'll never forget having the attorney in court, and literally as the victim was invited to read her victim impact statement, because I purposely hadn't gotten into the weeds of this case because I didn't want there to be the argument that the court had prejudged the defendant. So the victim comes to give her victim impact statement, outlines why she has no faith in the justice system because of her prior experiences. And while she's reading, the defense attorney begins slamming his attaché on the desk so that I can't hear the victim's statement. And it was unbelievable. And so I said first to the attorney that he had one more time to slam that briefcase, and I was going to clear out the jail so I can make room for him and his client if he didn't stop it. So he stops. Ultimately, the defendant doesn't apologize to the victim. He doesn't say anything. He admits that he referred to her as monkey mama, that he had done all these terrible things. And so I felt like this was something that did not deserve a normal run-of-the-mill type of sentence. So I did a couple things. The reason you got the call was because, yes, I ordered, and among the things he had to do was he had to sit at one of the busiest intersections in the city for several hours. He would be monitored by court staff, and he had to hold a sign that reflected how abhorrent his behavior was. And he was not happy. I didn't even want to leave it to him to create the message on the sign because I didn't want him to soften his behavior. And so the explanation of his behavior. And it was, of course, humiliating. And he said, I ruined his life. I think one thing that they didn't tell you on the paper is I also ordered that he do several hours of community service in a predominantly Black neighborhood, which is, you know, known as, you know, one that is particularly economically challenged and depressed, because I sincerely doubt he would go there and use that same language and that same treatment with the folks in that community, which he didn't, interestingly.
Well, I brought that up because there's a contrast. There is using non-traditional things that some people might see as humiliating, but there's a reason for it. Mm-hmm. And then there's just the ego-driven, like the matter in Michigan, which was the judge being offended because the person fell asleep in his courtroom, the 15-year-old girl. One is a provocation that was dealt with creatively by a judge, and the other one was just a judge presuming that the person was being disrespectful.
Absolutely.
Let me just move on to this, if I could. There are codes of judicial conduct and codes of judicial ethics all over the country. Every state has one. The federal judiciary has one. And there are model codes. And basically, they say that the judge shall require decorum and order in the courtroom. But the judge should be patient, dignified, courteous to litigants, jurors, witnesses, lawyers, court staff, court officials, and others whom the judge deals with in an official capacity. And the judge shall not commend or criticize jurors or people before the court. So there are guidelines, there are guardrails that a judge must follow. Now, within those guardrails, there's some flexibility, but judges just can't be kings and queens of their own domain.
I don't disagree at all. And you're right in that there's such a thing as discretion and latitude, but everything has bounds. And the code of ethics that governs the behavior of judges is really clear. I mean, crystal clear, just like you outlined it, as to what this treatment and how this treatment should look. Now, of course, there are those who appear in court or observe it from like that 30,000 foot view that might believe that, you know, some judges are just too nice. They're just too courteous. They're just, you know, too this. If you're the victim of a case, you might not want your judge being particularly respectful to the defendant. But as you said, that is more of an emotional response as opposed to the one that judges are required to engage in from a more practical, logical, legal standpoint. And actually, it leads me to the very question I was going to ask you, which is, I see this situation in Michigan as having had several other options to address it. But I wondered if you were similarly situated, how would you have handled this situation with the sleeping observer, whether it's a 15-year-old or otherwise? And is contempt an option? And if it is, how do you handle that?
No, I don't think that it's an option in this case. I would probably have, if it bothered me that much, and I'm not sure that it would have, but if it had bothered, I had other triggers, not that one.
Well, do tell.
If it had bothered me that much, I think I would have called the group supervisor or something to a sidebar off the record and said, you know, this is a problem. It's showing a lack of courtesy to the court. Is there some way that you can handle this? But that would be extreme. I just can't imagine having much of a reaction. You know, maybe it's because I've taught college students that spend the whole class on their phones.
I guess so. Either that, or you've got a slow docket day when you can just zero in on observers, not even litigants, but observers, you know, perhaps nodding off or sleeping. That, to me, says you don't have a whole lot going on your docket, because usually it's the folks immediately in front of you and related to what's in front of you that really can consume your whole attention span.
I want to talk about how you and I and other judges viewed the courtroom. I want to do it in this context. I don't think I had a God complex when I was judge, but I wanted to be in command of the courtroom. Now, not to the extreme that Judge King did in Michigan or people sleeping, but I wanted it to be, as I defined courts, a peaceful venue for the resolution of disputes, whether it's criminal or civil. That's basically what it is, a peaceful venue for the resolution of disputes. And in that, I thought to get respect from the people who were in front of me, I had to give them respect. And part of that was try to explain to them, sometimes the attorneys felt ad nauseum, that I would explain in lay language what we're trying to do with this podcast. I would explain to defendants or plaintiffs or people who were in front of me what the procedure was, what exactly was going to happen, what exactly was going to transpire, ask them if they had questions. Did they understand the procedure? Was there anything they wanted to ask me? You know, that was, to me, a sign of respect for them. And I had to give that from the bench before I could expect it back from them. What are your thoughts on that?
I think truer words never spoken. You are so very right. I would even take it a step further, because in my experience, even before I would get to the point of, as you said, kind of explaining, detailing, inviting questions ad nauseum, especially for self-represented litigants, for individuals who were just having one of their first experiences, or if they've had multiple experiences with the court system, but they did not have the benefit of an attorney standing next to them, kind of shepherding them through the process and advocating for them, I felt that it was a heightened duty to make sure that they understood and that the decisions they were making were intelligent. But even before I would get to that point of what you just described, I actually found that it was important to begin the process respectfully. And that starts with your very first engagement of an individual. It starts with referencing them as in whatever manner they are signaling to the court that they prefer. So if it is someone who is non-binary or someone who has a pronoun distinction, it is, in my belief, in my experience, I would ask if that is their preference. If there is someone who, you know, in my limited view, I might assume one thing, but they corrected me. In many instances, I would regularly ask someone to pronounce their surname for me because I wanted to get it right and I wanted to be respectful. And there are many times in a courtroom people will say, "Oh, well, you know, you did okay," or "That's fine," or, you know, "It doesn't matter." And I would remind them that it matters to me because respecting them and the baseline is, can you just get my name right? Can you just try to pronounce that? And I never refer to a litigant by their first name, ever. That was my personal golden rule, was to never refer to them by their first name. They were always Mr. or Ms., even though I know and I've had colleagues who would regularly reference litigants by their first name as a way to demean them or a way to, again, make sure that that power dynamic was really, really stressed. You don't need to stress a power dynamic when by the very pronouncement of your words, you can take someone's freedom. Trust me, they understand the dynamic.
You know, that power dynamic's interesting because in I served in two courts, one municipal court, which to our listeners out there in Ohio is a misdemeanor court, civil cases up to $15,000 and small claims. So it was a high volume court. I've always compared it to the ER of the judicial system.
As do I.
Because it's high volume. You don't have a lot of time to deal with cases. Some of them are minor and some of them are more serious. But, you know, I would not wear a robe. And I would in front of a jury, but in that court, I would not wear a robe because it was really, truly a people's court. There were a lot of people in there and a lot of people who were scared and never thought they would be in court. And they didn't need me having that extra trapping. So I would just wear a sport coat or a suit coat and a tie. I wouldn't wear a robe. Now, in common pleas, the higher level court in Ohio, where there are felonies and major civil cases, everything is serious. Mm-hmm. I would wear a robe all the time. So that's just a little thing that I would do to make people in the people's court more comfortable. If they were in the other court, I didn't care whether they were comfortable.
Well, and also understanding that, again, you're right. If you are in a municipal court, which does handle criminal matters, and in fact, you know, in Ohio, even if you are charged with the most serious felony offense, the first judge you're likely going to see is that municipal court judge because they have a duty and a responsibility to provide the preliminary hearing opportunities and to set bond, which are the conditions upon which you may share the community while your case is pending. That judge is the first judge you're going to see. That preliminary hearing is a hearing that's required by law to be held within a certain time frame that answers only two questions. Was a crime committed? And is this likely the person who committed the crime? It's very similar and actually identical to the same questions that are presented essentially to a grand jury when they are determining or deciding if they will return an indictment. The municipal court holds those same hearings. And you're absolutely right in that it really is. I do see municipal courts as the people's court. And although I never considered not wearing a robe, I was always conscientious of how that engagement happened. Because remember, judges expect to be referred to as judge. They expect that their orders are going to be abided by. They expect that people are going to be on their best behavior. And one way, and I actually teach judges this now when I teach access to justice, one way to ensure that you have, that you lower recidivism, which is that reoffending trigger, or the likelihood that someone will reoffend, increase the likelihood that court orders will be abided by, help to reinfuse faith in the system, is by infusing trust in the system. Most people don't trust the justice system anyways. And that surely includes the judges. They don't trust you. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily believe you're on their side. They don't believe that this system is going to work for them, especially if they come from a marginalized community. And it is the first best opportunity to help cure some of the things that are clearly ailing the justice system by doing exactly the things you just outlined, Judge, by, you know, maybe you don't wear your robe. Or if you do wear your robe, you don't have to be so overbearing in how you handle cases and even how you respond to folks when they are less than perfect. I used to say, especially for municipal court, Judge, I would see some good folks on their worst days. Yeah, it did right. not mean that they were bad people. It just right. meant they were good folks on their worst day. And I had to make sure that I was able to separate those things and treat them accordingly. You know, I will never forget, I had a case where, and it was a domestic violence, it's a criminal matter. It came before the municipal court. And it just so happens that the defendant in the case was the brother of one of our national football team members. So it was
right.
a famous brother. Well, it was the brother of a famous football player. And the victim in this particular case had obviously worked with police to bring forward this particular charge. And this goes to that point of trusting the justice system and having to quiet the noise sometimes, because I don't know about you, but I often had a lot of external noise, whether it was Edmund Aviv and he's upset, he's got to stand on the street corner, or it was, you know, other people who were not quite in tune or understanding the work of the court, even though you try to explain it.
Right.
But with this right. particular domestic violence case, it happened that the state was not very good at how they handled the case. They had done a very poor job of watching the clock to make sure the case was tried in a certain period of time. And judges know that some things that where they do have latitude over, some things they don't. So it required that the case be dismissed. And although it, at least on its face, appeared like, oh my gosh, this is so unfair, this is unright, what my role was as a judge is sort of like what you explained, which is having to explain, even if it's ad nauseum, that this is the court. This is not personal. I respect everyone. I respect all the rules that govern everyone. I have to make certain decisions. Defendants and victims need to know that. And if a court, if a judge is very clear at explaining that, I think you can do you can go a long way in helping them to appreciate and respect the work of the court. In this instance, however, you know, I had, you know, people like the mayor who, I mean, she couldn't get a law degree if they gave it to her in a Cracker Jack box, who had an opinion about the rulings of the court without learning the process. And that's all designed for other reasons that have nothing to do with the court. But I say that to say it can do the exact opposite of what you're yeah. trying to do, which is infuse faith and trust. It can have people not trusting the system because you have people who don't understand or know the system having opinions and loud opinions about it, while as the judge, you're constantly working to combat that. And for like in the case in Michigan, I'm sure that judge there is probably rethinking what his behavior was, because now everybody's got an opinion about it. And now he's sidelined with his thoughts.
No matter how we try, though, as judges to have decorum, we're dealing with, sometimes I used to refer to all the people in front of me as the great unwashed. I mean, they just come in.
I like that.
In masses. There were things that didn't bother me because the judge is supposed to control the courtroom besides the himself or herself. And what there have been studies that show this, that defendant's behavior or party's behavior in civil cases, either plaintiff or defendant, has become more outrageous since all these TV shows are on. Judge Judy, and it went back to the original People's Court for Judge Wapner.
That's a reach back.
remember all of that? It gives license to people before the court to act disrespectful.
Do you think it gives license, or do you think that there?
I think it gives license. Okay. I think people see that and go, "Well, I can do that." I mean, that's appropriate behavior.
So one-upsmanship. You think there's the idea of one-upsmanship,
or to talk over the other party, and not follow the rules. So every judge has ways of coping with that group in front of him or her. And most of the time, I could do it. But
sounds like there are a time or two when you're like, maybe not today.
There are triggers. And one trigger is when someone won't shut up. They just keep going and going and going. And I found this more just recently. Last year, I was sitting in court, and people on video from the jail, they just keep talking. And so, I mean, I'm sitting there waiting for them to take a breath so I can jump in to explain to them what was going to happen, or what we were there for. So people that won't shut up, just that was a trigger for me.
Our listeners, I'll have you know that Judge Tom and I regularly engage in therapy, because I'm sure he believes I am just like some of those defendants who will not shut up, especially when I've got a point. But it's okay. We're friends, I'm perfectly fine with that.
I didn't say that. Now,
my question to you is, in that being a trigger, if you were put in a position to advise or mentor a new judge, what would you tell them to do when they are being triggered by a defendant? Whether it's, you know, talking too much or over talking the judge or not paying attention or refusing to cooperate, what advice would you give that judge?
Well, not to do what I did once, which was the defendant went on and on and on. I mean, over 5 minutes, just continually just babbling and being abusive and everything. And I just, he wouldn't listen to me. Just acted like he didn't hear me. So I screamed on the record in front of the whole courtroom, "Shut the hell up."
Oh, no.
Or I'm going to put your ass in jail.
And you weren't done. Shut the hell up. Or here are your choices.
So that's what I would advise not to do.
Well, at least you gave him options.
He shut up.
I was going to say, I think I would have sucked all of the air out of the room.
but Your question is, you know, you just have to be patient. You just have to let people have their say. Sometimes people just want to have their say. You know, how many times have we heard, I wasn't going more than 5 miles an hour over the speed limit. Okay, were you going over the speed limit? Well, yes, but I was only going over 5 miles per hour over the speed limit. Well, you still were speeding
over the speed limit, right? Yeah.
So, but they want to have their say. And so as much as possible, give them their say. Yeah, that would be my advice.
You're so right. And I think active listening, right? So just in the speed limit example is you show that you're actively listening. I gave you an opportunity to respond and say, yes, you were going over the limit by 5. Okay, so that meant you were traveling. You were going over the limit, even if it was over by 5. At least you've now acknowledged to the litigant that I heard you. I gave you an opportunity to explain. That may not change the outcome. And I genuinely believe, and I know this to be the fact, to the case, that when litigants, especially defendants, feel like they've been heard, they will honor and respect the court's decision, even if it's right. Not what they would have preferred.
I agree with you 100% on that. I agree with you 100%.
And it's all because you gave them their say, just like you said. You gave them that voice, that opportunity to be heard. But another thing, and Judge, you tell me how you feel about this. The other thing is making them feel, believe, and know that they're being treated the same as everybody else.
Yeah, and especially with, and I had a ton of these, I'm sure you did too, low-income defendants. You know, they come in thinking that the ones that can hire a lawyer are going to get a better shake. You know, so I have to treat them with extra care, you know, to make sure that they understand that they're going to be treated the same as anybody else.
Right.
And so that's a major communications issue.
Exactly. Know? Especially if they're sitting in the back of the courtroom.
Yeah.
And they're watching you and they're listening to how you engage or you react with defendants or litigants that have attorneys or with other people. And if they're sitting in the back of the courtroom and everybody else in the room up until that point has been Mr. or Ms. or so-and-so, and they walk up and for whatever reason, you don't like the message on their shirt. And how many times have we had that happen, right?
Gosh.
Somebody comes in and you're just like, come on,
sometimes
really?
Sometimes they're funny, but I can't laugh. But you go ahead.
But of all the things to pick out to wear to court today,
right.
You pick that one, right? I mean,
looked in the mirror this morning and went, this is what I'm wearing to court.
Right. You're like, yep, that works. It's like, are we really, we're seriously doing this? Okay. And if they've seen and heard you treat others a certain way, and then it comes to them, and all of a sudden they are referenced by their first name, they have no attorney. So you're like, hurry up, let's go. We got to get this taken care of. Nobody's got time to be dealing with you. All of a sudden, it really does send a certain kind of message. It could send a certain message to that particular litigant about how you view them, how you view their case, how you value or don't who they are. And all of this can really impact, again, back to that whole point of about trust in the system and how people view it. I mean, and I don't know about you, I used to have, you know, when talking about this judge here in Michigan, I used to have a program called Democracy Days. It was specifically designed for young people to come in and to observe. And if I had a young person that came in and nodded off or fell asleep or was texting the person next to them or whispering back and forth, I was already prepared for it because they're kids. And I knew
that's right.
I knew that was going to happen because they're kids. Yes, some of it might be interesting, but some of it just may not be. And the one opportunity that the judge gave up here was really being able to connect with kids and to make this system make sense to them. Because at some point, they're going to be young adults or adults that have to actually operate in a civilized society where these same rules are going to apply to them. And let's face it, everybody's broken a rule. If you've ever gotten a speeding ticket, if you've ever gotten a citation, if you've ever had to, you know, pay a fine, everybody has broken a rule. Let's not make a kid, a 15-year-old, feel like they have committed the cardinal sin by falling asleep in your courtroom before they can ever even, you know, reach voter registration age. Really?
Right. I was tougher on attorneys than I am or were on defendants or parties, especially if they did not have an attorney.
Like, and my lawyer slamming his briefcase on the table.
And attorneys would trigger me far quicker than other people. I just could not stand attorneys who were late. For no reason. I couldn't stand attorneys who sat in courtroom and did the big eye rolls or give the side eye to me. That just pissed me off.
I will tell you, I can forgive lateness. What I cannot forgive is constantly not showing up. If I've set hearings and if your client is here and you don't respect this court enough to show up and to provide notice or request to be excused or a request to, you know, move the date, then that to me is just unforgivable. Yes, I'm here every day. I'm doing this job every day. But you have no respect for your client and what it may take, what they may be losing by way of wages, what they may have to do to manage or rearrange their life to be here. They're afraid they're going to go to jail if they don't show up.
Yeah.
And you blow it off. I have a huge problem. I've had times when I've encouraged defendants to file disciplinary complaints against their lawyers for failing to show up.
I also hate the big sighs. The attorneys who sit at counsel table and you as the judge say something, the attorney goes,
yes, because of course they can all do the job better than you.
Oh, that just got under my skin. Now, most of the time I could control that occasionally. After I've told an attorney five times not to do something, they continue doing it. That prompted a little side discussion at the bench, not in the presence of the jury, but I had more trouble with controlling the triggers with attorneys than I did with the average person in the courtroom. One other thing I want to talk about, and that is sometimes things in the courtroom are flat out funny.
Yes.
I know that judges and journalists and cops, and I'm two out of the three, a judge and a journalist, we all have sort of gallows humor, but sometimes things are just hysterically funny and you want to laugh and you cannot.
Yeah.
So,
or sometimes you just can't help it. You cannot.
I kept my decorum. That's when I did keep my decorum. But I developed the way of underneath the bench, pinching the inside of my thigh.
My God.
So that it would hurt, so that I would not laugh at thing. So that was part of my technique to maintain judicial decorum.
Oh, that is funny.
In the courtroom.
That's funny. I have to say, I did not develop such a technique because here's what I believed, especially as a municipal court judge, and you said this at the when you were describing it as the people's court, is sometimes I would engage in that laughter because I wanted the litigants, and I wanted everyone else in the room to know that I'm a human being that has emotions. They, you know, it's something that would, you know, sometimes be funny to everyone in the room. And I didn't feel a need to pretend like it wasn't comedic or it wasn't hilarious. It doesn't excuse the behavior, but I think it humanizes judges to say, you know what, I get it. I think that's funny. Of course, that doesn't excuse the behavior, but you're right. I mean, there's a reason why the whole room is laughing, and there's a reason why I'm laughing with you, because yeah, that's pretty hilarious. Yep.
I had two women in a trailer park in small claims one time. One was suing the other for $500 for destroying her reputation. And I asked,
goodness.
How did the woman destroy her reputation? Well, she came out on the porch of her trailer, and she called me a name. I said, well, I need to know what the name was. And she said, I'm a Christian woman, I can't say. Ooh. I said, well, can you spell it? And she said, yes, I think I can. She came out and she called me a dirty H-O-R.
So, I'd like to buy a vowel.
Yeah, and a consonant. And a consonant.
And a consonant.
A couple of consonants.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And so,
I'd like to buy an E and that a was, W.
That was a time. That was the time where my thighs really got to work out.
Oh,
because
that's
hilarious. It wasn't funny. She didn't think of it. Wasn't a funny situation. It wasn't funny to her. It was just funny to me, and I couldn't let on that was going on. A couple of quick things before we.
That's hilarious. A dirty one. That's a Christian woman for you.
Yeah, yeah. She called me a dirty whore, but H O R.
I love it.
She didn't get her $500, but anyway.
Hey, listen, I had a civil case where I had two longtime friends. These gentlemen had been friends from, I don't know, probably elementary school. One got sick, and, you know, to help console the other during his convalescing stage, the friend loaned him a Superman comic book. And if you know anything about Northeast Ohio Superman, it's huge, really huge. Yep. He loans him a Superman comic book. And my gosh, when the friend got well and returned the comic book, you know, the spine of the comic book was a little tattered. And
oh,
he
yeah.
was suing his friend over the destruction, the absolute destruction of this Superman comic book. You would have thought he had almost set it on fire. But if you saw it, he was so emotional. He look at this book. Look at it. It's worthless now. Look how he treated it. And it was, I will tell you, it was minimal damage, but it was clearly deep emotional damage. And of course, he was suing his friend for like $3,500 for this comic book. And he didn't get it. But it was, I found it funny because I just could not believe that long-term friends were fighting over a comic book.
Well, try my trick next time you're sitting on the bench on assignment. It works every time. It makes for painful bruises on the inside.
I was
going to
say, some medical professional is going to ask if I'm safe at home if I use that trick.
A couple of other things before we bounce out of here. And one is judges also have to have a sense of decorum outside of the courtroom. Once a judge, always a judge, is the sort of adage. But people really do look at you, how you behave. You know, whether you're drunk at a party or you know, all of the things that maybe normal people do as they're blowing off steam. Judges can't do. So it's not your decorum's not just limited to the courtroom. It's everything. I had very quickly. I had a situation in my community. I was at a stoplight walking as a pedestrian, and there was absolutely no traffic at this particular time. And so I walked on a don't walk sign while I was a judge, and sure enough. It was like in a movie. There was an old lady on the other side who came up and said, "You're the judge, right? You're one of the judges, right?" "Yes." "What'd you just do?" "I walked across the street." "No, you didn't. You walked across on a don't walk sign.
You jaywalked.
How can you expect people to follow the law if you don't?"
Oh,
you
know? No.
And so since that day, I've never walked on a don't walk sign. I don't care what the traffic pattern is. She embarrassed me, but she made a point. You know, people look at judges as not being superhuman, but you're supposed to conduct yourself with a sense of decorum.
And I think that's also why, to you know, a great degree, we express such disappointment when it comes to Supreme Court justices, right? Because we have this expectation that, heck, if especially in small communities where you cannot live your life under the radar, you're going to be known and identified by people over and over again. Well, and so you live your life understanding that just like the little old lady on the other side of the street will call you out for jaywalking, we as judges know that when it comes to our highest court in the land, we're expecting that we are sometimes the little lady on the other side of the street, right? We're calling it out because there's an expectation that they will set the tone for the whole, all of the judiciary, and that they will follow the rules, and that they won't keep walking across the street on a don't walk sign and saying, "Nah, nah, 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 I don't have to follow the rules, but you do," and kind of thumbing their nose at the rest of us, because no more than that lady wanted you thumbing your nose at her and saying, "Yeah, I'm the judge. And so even if I got a citation, I could get out of it." It actually triggered your conscience to say, "Yeah, I will do better." And that's what we hope to see out of our justices at the highest court, which is where we are calling you out on this as fellow judges, never mind the media, never mind everybody else, but the folks who are looking to you for guidance. We're calling you out on this, and we hope that that would trigger your conscience.
One last thing, Judge Gale, and that is people who feel that they've been abused by a judge or that a judge has not followed the appropriate code of conduct in the courtroom or outside of the courtroom.
Oh, like this Michigan judge.
In every state, and in the federal system, there are ways to report that, whether it's at a state Supreme Court or whether it's at a state bar association, you can report it and somebody at that level will investigate that judge's conduct. So I encourage our audience out there, if you think that you have been abused by a judge in some way, file a report. File a report and see if it can't be resolved. It will improve the judicial system, and it also gives you some relief from being demeaned by an egomaniac.
And indeed, and I guess my only caveat to that would say I would encourage listeners that to really assess the situation, if you believe that it is a legitimate mistreatment by the judge, because right, there are some individuals who could take that and would say, "Oh, well, this is my way to kind of keep the judge in check, is I can threaten to file these disciplinary actions."
And, oh, we've all had that, right?
Exactly. And it's, and these aren't often by litigants, right? These are sometimes by, you know, egomaniacal individuals who also themselves are in positions of authority, although they should not be. That said, though, I would encourage you to really consider, first of all, we want to improve the judiciary as a whole. And in improving the judiciary does mean in improving it by imposing accountability, which is why we talk so much about the Supreme Court justices, because we believe that there's accountability that's necessary. And that flows all the way down.
And Judge, you're a fellow at the National Judicial College. I know the Judicial College talks about decorum a lot, and about judicial demeanor. And I know you teach courses on it. So it's something
absolutely
that's in the front of judges' minds.
And one last thing I'll say, and Judge, I believe you would agree with this, is not only are we talking about the behavior of the judge themselves, but remember, the judge's staff is a reflection of the judge. And so judges don't want to know that they're working with people who, although they are working hard to be respectful and to show decorum and patience in the courtroom, only for them to have the complete opposite experience in the clerk's office or with the bailiffs, or if there's a probation department that's connected to the court. Those are also kind of arms, if you will, of the judge themselves. And so, again, bringing that to the court's attention actually gives the judge an opportunity to help improve the overall justice system, not just that in-court experience,
absolutely,
but to improve the entire experience, no matter what point you enter the justice system at.
We want to thank all of you for listening to this episode of Next Witness, Please. And Judge Gale, it's your time to give your pitch.
This is always fun to do this. So listen, we hope that you found value in the work that we're doing. And so we invite you to follow us on all of the platforms where you find your favorite podcasts. We'd like to start with our perhaps most ardent supporter, that being NPR. So you can check us out on NPR, on Spotify, on Apple, on Amazon, or Audible, or any place else that you would find your favorite podcast. Like us, rate us, and make sure you come back and listen again.
And if you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can email it to me at Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. And if you have topics that you'd like for us to cover in the future, we're accumulating several that people have sent in. Please shoot us an email. And again, that's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and our crack audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, thanks, Judge Gale, and I hope everyone has a good day.
It's always fun, Judge Tom. Thanks again.